Session number 12371, Reel 9.
Whereas those in a minority knew that almost every aircraft they saw was hostile. Our aim, of course, was to manoeuvre ourselves into such a position that we could make a dash for the cloud, which was about 500 or 600 feet above us. Now, the hurricane had an emergency boost, and this allowed you to go from a maximum of, I think it was 6 pounds in boost, to 12 pounds. And you did this by pulling on a red knob that was situated on the left side of the instrument panel. You pulled this out about 3 inches, and it was on a wire. And this immediately gave you access to this additional boost, which you could only use for a limited length of time, because otherwise there was a good chance you'd blow your engine up. But it was for purposes such as this, where you suddenly needed extra speed just for a short time. Well, after some rather dicey moments, we all made cloud and headed back for Manston individually, and we landed. And as we were walking back to dispersal, I said, "By God, that was a dicey do." And the Canadian said, "I wasn't concerned." He said, "I knew we'd get home all right." And I suddenly looked down and I said, "What's that you've got in your hand?" And he'd got the red emergency boost with about 3 feet of cable on it, but he pulled it right out of the instrument panel. Well, these operations with the 40mm cannon were obviously limited because of the number of aircraft we have fitted with that weapon. And as I say, because one was so defenseless, one really had to go in pretty bad weather, which made the location of targets not too easy. The big moment really was to come with the hurricanes with the rockets. As I say, we'd had a certain amount of success with them. I say a certain amount because there weren't all that many targets against the various shipping targets. But up until now, of course, we hadn't been able to carry them over land. But now we were going to attack the first land target that was ever attacked with this weapon. And this was because the Air Ministry felt they wanted the weapon used against the land target, and they had selected a particular target that they felt was vital to the Germans at that particular time. However, before we get on to that, I'll just tell you the story of what the chief instructor at Millfield told me was inevitable, and that was that somebody would fire one of these rockets on the ground at one stage, and that once it was done, it would never happen again. Late one afternoon, I just landed, having done a night flying test, ready for the night's operations. I was just bending over the flight authorization book to sign myself off, when suddenly I heard whoosh like that, and I recognized the sound straight away. And I rushed outside, and there was an airman lying flat on his back, and other airmen standing around, absolutely startled and white as sheets. And what had happened was that this aircraft was getting ready, being got ready for night operations. And what happened, the way they did this was, all the 8 rockets were mounted on the rails, but the pigtails weren't plugged in. They were just hanging down. The electricians operated in pairs. One of them had a test bulb, which he plugged into the various sockets under the wing, and he'd plug it into to the first socket, and there'd be another electrician sitting in the cockpit. And bearing in mind, as a parachute wasn't in the aircraft, he was sitting in the well of the seat, and therefore his head was below the level of the top of the cockpit. The electrician outside called out, "Contact," and the electrician in the cockpit would turn on the first switch, push the button on top of the throttle, which was the firing button, and the light would light up, which would show that that socket was working. And then he'd do it down the next three sockets on that side, and then he'd go around the other side. Well, the electrician retired round the other side, and the armourer turned up. Now, the armourer's job, having assembled the rocket, which was now on the aircraft, or the eight rockets, was to plug in the pigtails. And he comes along, there's nobody about, or so it would appear, and so he plugged in the first pigtail just at the time that the electrician on the other side was saying to the electrician in the cockpit, "Contact," and he switches on the first switch, which, of course, is connected to the rail on the other side as well as on this side, and off goes the rocket. Well, the armourer was very lucky. It knocked him over backwards. The fact that the aeroplane was in the position it was, in a tail-down position, meant that the rocket was pointing slightly up in the air. But because these rockets didn't reach their proper trajectory for firing, unless the aircraft was doing 220 miles an hour, it obviously selected its own trajectory. Now, if the aircraft had been pointing 1 degree to starboard, that rocket would have gone straight through station headquarters and caused unknown damage and goodness knows what casualties. As it was, it headed across the airfield with this 60-pound explosive head on the front, where 609's Typhoons had just landed from an operation and were in a big circle round a petrol bowser that was standing on a hard standing. The rocket arrived, and because of the shallow trajectory on which it was flying, it hit the hard standing at an angle so that the head didn't explode. And it ricocheted off the hard standing and went on its way, and it was eventually found about a quarter of a mile away in a field. The extraordinary thing was that none of the 609 squadron people were aware that this had happened. And that was our rocket that was fired, and it never happened again.
Where was that?
At Manston.
And this was in August 1943. I'm going to return to the time when we had the whirlwinds for a moment, because there is quite an interesting story about the day that number 137 squadron captured a German. In the Royal Air Force, capturing one of the enemy was a fairly rare event and only happened if somebody bailed out or something like that and happened to land nearby. But the capture was usually made under these circumstances by the police or the army or something like that. It was most unusual for RAF pilots to be around when this happened. However, in this about the spring of 1943, a German ME-109 suddenly landed at Manston in daylight. He landed on the opposite side of the airfield to where my squadron, number 137 squadron, was situated, and very close to where the other squadron on the airfield, number 609, was situated. At Manston, in those days, and still today in fact, there is a road that runs right across the middle of the airfield. And until the large runway was built in round about 1943, much of our takeoff and landing involved us going across this road. But the area that had been prepared for takeoff and landing, when it got to the road, there had been various smoothing made so that when one actually crossed the road, it didn't cause one any undue disturbance. However, the German didn't realize this, and of course he landed to the left of the prepared surface, and when he hit the road, he broke the stern frame of his aircraft. It was at this stage, so far as I can gather, that he realized that he'd landed on an English airfield, but he couldn't get off again because his aeroplane was broken. The result was that the pilots of 609 Squadron rushed out of their dispersal and took charge of the pilot. They had captured a German. And we, in our squadron, were very jealous of this because, as I said before, this was a rare event. They did, in fact, treat their captured German very well. They took photographs of him. They took a photograph of him with Wing Commander Goat, who was the mascot of 609 Squadron at the time, and they then took him down to the mess and gave him lunch. Subsequently, when one of the interrogators came to collect him, he was absolutely furious that number 609 Squadron had treated their captured airmen so well, because these interrogators relied on gaining the confidence of their captured enemy in order to prepare them for interrogation. And they hoped that when they arrived to pick up the captured German, that he was probably unhappy and frightened, and that they could then pose as his friend. But it was very difficult to pose as this chap's friend when he'd been treated so well. And the interrogator was very angry that he had been treated so well because, to a certain extent, it had destroyed the effectiveness of his interrogation. Anyway, he took the German away. And that was really the end of that part of the incident, and we felt, as I say, very jealous. However, about 2 or 3 months later, the Germans launched a series of attacks on London during the Moon period with single-seat, single-engine fighter bombers. This was the ME-109 and the FW-190, principally. These aircraft each carried something equivalent to about a 500-pound bomb. And, of course, in so doing, it meant that they couldn't carry long-range tanks. And so it meant that their range was very limited. It allowed them to get to London and back to France, from where they had to operate from only certain airfields, which kept them within range of London. This posed a great difficulty for our night fighter defences because the aircraft were going so quickly that our Mosquitoes, which form the principal force of the night fighter defences, were unable to catch them. And of course this was the whole object of the German attack. These aircraft came in very quickly. They just dropped their bombs haphazardly on London and then shot out again. And these raids were given the name of the Scalded Cat Raids. I can't remember who coined that phrase. It was probably the newspapers. Well, as I said, the defence against this attack was not easy. And so it was decided that the best way to try and either reduce it or defeat it altogether was to attack the airfields from which these fighters were operating. As I said, they were limited in number because they had to be within range of London, and there were only a certain number of airfields that fulfilled this particular requirement. We knew which all these airfields were. Now, this was a time when we were just changing over from the Whirlwind to the Hurricane. But we still had a number of Whirlwinds left, and it was this aircraft that we were going to use to carry out these attacks on these German airfields, because number 137 Squadron was the squadron selected for this particular role. Now, the way our operation worked was that the Germans used a different airfield every night, and they moved their fighter aircraft in such a way that they couldn't be plotted by our low-level radars that were situated around the Dover area and along the southeast coast. They would fly them from one base to the other at low level, and so it was difficult for us to know from which airfield they were going to operate. However, we did acquire this information through two sources. One was through the French underground, and the other was through the Y service, which was, of course, the radio listening service, which was listening out to German broadcasts on a 24-hour basis. The extraordinary thing was that however much the Germans tried to maintain radio silence, there was always an occasion when somebody made a noise, albeit very briefly, on the radio. It was usually a radio mechanic who was servicing the radio in a particular aircraft for the evening's operations. He just had to make one bleep and the Y service would pick him up. We, with our Whirlwinds at Manston, had a direct line to the Y service. We had courses worked out to all the airfields that the Germans could possibly use for this operation. We had our aircraft armed, each with two 250-pound bombs. And directly the Y service had identified the airfield from which the Germans were going to operate that night. They phoned it through to number 137 Squadron, and immediately we set off single aircraft to maintain a standing patrol over that airfield. We would shoot up any aircraft that tried to take off or land, and if there was a silent period when nothing seemed to be happening, we'd drop one of our bombs just to remind the Germans that we were there. Directly an aircraft had reached the end of its patrol and had to return to Manson, it was immediately relieved by another aircraft. And over the period of the night, the moonlight night, we would probably use about 5 aircraft, each relieving the other on these patrols. Needless to say, with the German anti-aircraft defences as good as they were, it wasn't all milk and honey carrying out these patrols, because the Germans were constantly shooting at one. One kept out of range of their guns as much as one could, but of course one had to get inside their range when one either attacked an aircraft or dropped one of these bombs. However, during the period that No. 137 Squadron were carrying out these operations, we didn't lose anybody. One night, we had been carrying out this role against an airfield called Poix, which is near Amiens, which, funnily enough, was an airfield that I was based on in 1939, when we first went to France at the beginning of the war. I had already carried out my patrol and was back at Manston, and we were now waiting for our last aircraft to come back. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, not long before dawn, and the aircraft was flown by my senior flight commander, Mike Brown. We were sitting in the intelligence debriefing room, those of us who already finished our patrols, drinking coffee and chatting, when all of a sudden I heard an aircraft fly overhead that sounded like an Oxford, which of course was a training aircraft. Now, this particular area was a prohibited area. In other words, so far as being on the ground was concerned, you were not allowed into it unless you were either stationed there or you lived there. And of course, quite a lot of the people who actually lived in this area had left and their houses were empty. The same yardstick applied to any aircraft flying in the area. Certainly, training aircraft were not supposed to be in the area. And I thought to myself, well, it's strange that an Oxford should be flying over here, certainly at this hour of the night. About a couple of minutes later, the telephone rang, and a breathless WAF voice from air traffic control said, an FW-190 has just landed. Well, we didn't need second bidding. We all rushed out onto the airfield. The landing area to which I referred earlier went very close to where we were, a matter of 150 yards away. And this 190 had just come to a halt. We surrounded it. I had my revolver with me. I climbed up on the wing. The pilot opened his hood, obviously expecting to get a friendly welcome in German. And I said to him, "Welcome to Manston," and stuck my revolver in his ear and told him to get out. He was alarmed and obviously surprised. So we'd now captured our German. We took him into the briefing room, but we now had another problem, and that was that this 190, with its propeller still ticking over, was standing in the middle of the runway, the grass runway, and my flight commander was now back on the circuit, getting short of fuel and wanting to land. I might add that had he, Mike Brown, realized that there was a German on the circuit, he would have had no compunction whatsoever. He'd have shot him down. So we now had to move this aircraft. Well, I had never been in a 190 in my life before, but I decided that I somehow got to move it off the runway. It was the latest model, and so you can well see the apprehension I had that I might pull the wrong lever and perhaps pull the undercarriage up or something terrible like that. Anyway, I got into the aircraft and looked around the cockpit, and of course the Germans seemed to have more electrics in their aircraft. There seemed to be a mass of switches, and I really didn't know which one I was meant to push and pull. Anyway, I was looking round when one of my pilots called up to me and said, "Look out, he may have thrown a switch, and when you open the throttle, it'll blow up." Well, I prayed, opened the throttle, hoped for the best, and sure enough, the engine accelerated, and I was able to taxi the aircraft off the runway area so that my flight commander could land. Subsequently, we were able to stop the engine, and the aircraft was put away in a hangar and was eventually flown away by a test pilot from either Farnborough or Boscombe Down. We had this German, who was an NCO, in the briefing room. He didn't speak any English. He looked very glum, and we put an armed guard on him. The intelligence officer rang up the interrogator, and the interrogator said to him, "In no circumstances are you to give him anything to eat. You're just to leave him there, and I will be with you at about 8 o'clock in the morning." The time was now something like 4:30 or 5 o'clock. Well, I decided that I was going off to bed and that I'd probably try and get back to see what the interrogator had to say when he arrived. The intelligence officer, who was due to be relieved, decided that he'd better stay on duty until the interrogator arrived so that he could give him the full details of this German's arrival. I came back at about 8:30, still no sign of this interrogator, who eventually turned up at 11 o'clock. He then asked the German if he'd had anything to eat, and the German rather mournfully said no, whereupon the interrogator turned on the unfortunate intelligence officer, who had now been on duty for about 12 hours and had a beard, and tore him off a strip for not giving the German anything to eat. Naturally, the intelligence officer was very hurt by this remark, but this was all part of the interrogator's ploy to gain the confidence and friendship of the German pilot. We then learnt with interest why he had arrived at Manston. He had taken off from Poix, and he'd flown to London to drop his bomb. Now, I must admit that it was a misty night, but we have been going backwards and forwards to Poix without any difficulty. But this German had arrived over London, he dropped his bomb, and had obviously got too far north. And the result was, when he turned to return to France, he crossed the Thames estuary and thought he was crossing the Channel. By this time, he was getting short of fuel. Unfortunately for him, our flashing beacon, which we turned on when the visibility was beginning to drop, our flashing beacon was flashing M for Manston, which was the same identification that a flashing beacon on Cap Grenet in France was to flash, and this chap therefore thought that he was over France. He saw this airfield and decided to land, and he landed thinking he was landing in France.